Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, a podcast that's all about comic book movies, brought to you by FilmDivider.com. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are...
Seb Patrick.
And James Hunt.
We'll discuss the latest comic book movie and TV news before launching into our spoiler-filled discussion of Matthew Vaughn's 2010 film, Kick-Ass. But before any of that, I'm going to ask Seb and James to explain a comic book concept that, as a movie fan, I just don't understand. Seb, James, I've been reading about the Justice League Dark this week. Now, that's not just Batman and Superman with the lights turned off, right?
No, it's not a Zack Snyder directed Batman
and Superman. Oh, hey-oh.
Whenever I see the name Justice League Dark, it just makes me think that it's like a brand of box of chocolates. It's just one of the most ridiculous names for anything. The history's kind of... it's actually a relatively recent thing as a concept. But basically, to sort of give you as brief as I can, and I know these aren't always super brief, overview of the history of it all. From about... well, we talked on the Blade episode about how in the late 70s you had this kind of growing tradition of horror and supernatural comics again at DC and Marvel. And at DC, this particularly took root in the early 80s, and I've just realised I've made a brilliant pun by saying took root, because it took root with Swamp Thing, particularly, and the run on Swamp Thing by Alan Moore. And that basically spawned a whole subgenre in DC of supernatural characters in the DC universe. And John Constantine, Hellblazer, first appeared in Swamp Thing as well, and you had various other characters who started to appear over that period. So, but by the time you got to the mid to late 80s, those characters were being used in comics that were quite, mature and adult. Some more mature than others, but, you know, it was kind of more of an adult audience were reading them. And mainly inspired by the success of The Sandman, DC created the Vertigo imprint, to basically put all of the kind of grown-up supernatural characters into that. Now, obviously, around about the same time, they had also had the Crisis on Infinite Earths, which was a reboot of the continuity. So this was a useful point at which they could, even though the Crisis was a little bit earlier, they could have the excuse to shunt these characters actually out of the DC universe. So you have this weird situation with Sandman, actually, where Sandman started before Vertigo began. And early on, in early issues of Sandman, it is very... clearly connected to the DC universe. The Martian Manhunter from Justice League appears in one of the early issues.
Right.
But by the time Sandman finished, Vertigo had been established. And the rule with Vertigo was basically these characters aren't in the DC universe. So John Constantine, who had always been a part of the DC universe and who had hung out with superheroes, was now completely in his own universe that had no superheroes in it and, you know, had nothing to do with the rest of the DC universe. So that was the status quo kind of pretty much throughout the 90s and 2000s. But then one of the things that DC did when they did the Flashpoint New 52 reboot in 2011 was to get rid of Vertigo completely. One of the side effects of this was that Hellblazer finally finished with its 300th issue, and like his story was actually brought to an end. Not like a completely definitive end, but the comic finished and had a proper ending. And one of the things that DC decided they wanted to do was to bring back all of these supernatural characters and have them be in the DC universe, including a new, younger version of John Constantine, who was a little bit more like he had been in the Swamp Thing days, rather than the grizzled 50-year-old. Because in Hellblazer, Constantine had always been allowed to age in real time, which doesn't really happen in comics, as you know. But by the time Hellblazer ended, Constantine was in his kind of late 40s, early 50s. So they, as part of the New 52 relaunch, one of the new titles that they launched was called Justice League Dark, and is essentially a team book featuring various supernatural characters, including John Constantine and Zatanna, who is a magician character who I really like, and various others. Basically, any character who was quite popular in a Vertigo comic in the late 80s who could reasonably fit into a superhero book, they put into Justice League Dark. I only read a few issues of it. It's had some quite good writers on it, Jeff Lemire and J.M. DeMatteis, and it was reasonably enjoyable. I wasn't really interested in those characters not being in their own, you know, kind of Vertigo books. It's sort of, yeah. So I would imagine if they did a film, I can't see it tying into the other DC films. I think it would still have to be its own thing, and I think calling it Justice League Dark would be utterly ridiculous. But I think the idea of doing a film of those characters as a team could be a good idea.
Well, let's segue straight into the news piece that relates to that this week then, because since about, I think, 2012, Guillermo del Toro was working on a Justice League Dark film, and that kind of hung around in the ether for quite a while. But obviously within the period, DC's kind of plans, long-term plans, completely changed. Del Toro kind of has taken a step back, but had developed it for quite a while and had handed in a version of the script. And so this project still exists. And the latest rumour this week is that it might actually be going ahead and happening with Evil Dead director Fede Alvarez, remake director, obviously. Although Sam Raimi doing this would be cool. And then the directing duo of Aaron Casales and Navot Papachardo, who apparently directed a film called Big Bad Wolves, they are both rumoured to be being considered for the directing job on this film, which suggests that it's actually moving ahead. There are casting rumours that Colin Farrell will be playing John Constantine, Ron Perlman playing Swamp Thing, Ewan McGregor for Jason Blood / The Demon, Monica Bellucci as Madame Xanadu, and Ben Mendelsohn as the villain Anton Arcane. I guess that could exist in the same universe as the main one for DC.
I can see them setting it in the same universe as the other stuff. I mean, if they really want to do the Marvel thing.
I do kind of think if you're going to do this, and Guillermo del Toro's not doing it, then I'm not sure what the point of doing it is. It's like, it's just so tailor-made for him to do that if he's not going to do it, it might just end up feeling like a poor imitation of a Guillermo del Toro film.
To be fair, not having a particular reason to make a film hasn't stopped them making Suicide Squad.
Well, that's the other thing. I just wonder if it's... I mean, it's not obviously going to be exactly the same subject matter as Suicide Squad, but given that they're already doing Suicide Squad, I think this is too similar to it in terms of being, you know, an unconventional group of characters in a superhero trope framework.
It's kind of a super team of C-listers to pad out their universe quickly. It would seem to serve the same function as Suicide Squad.
And if they're going to do that, why not go ahead and do Justice League International, and then at least you might get something lighthearted out of it. Maybe that's
lighthearted,
next, I don't know.
That's the problem. Like, DC doesn't want a lighthearted movie. Well, that would shatter their brand.
What do you think then? If those rumours are true, I mean, I wasn't a big fan of the Evil Dead remake, but I thought Fede Alvarez at least seemed like he had a handle and a clear vision with that movie. I don't know the other two guys. And then, I don't know, like, cast-wise, I mean, those could be completely fan-cast, because it's just rumours, but any movie with Colin Farrell, Ron Perlman, Ewan McGregor, Monica Bellucci and Ben Mendelsohn would have my money opening night.
Yeah, wouldn't have any of its own money left, though. There's no way they can afford all of those in a fucking Justice League Dark movie.
I'm pretty sure Colin Farrell has been being linked with being a possible John Constantine for about as long as the internet has been talking about comic book movies. You know, if he can do a Scouse accent, then I'm all for it.
Okay, well, we'll move on now. And our second piece of news isn't really news. And we're probably going to talk about more about this show more in the next couple of weeks once we've actually watched it all. But Jessica Jones is online. Full disclosure, we are recording this on Sunday night, so we haven't watched all of it yet, although I'm sure some of you had got it finished by Friday night. But we're at various different stages throughout the season between us. So I thought if we just kind of discuss between us, guys, our initial impressions and whether it's lived up to expectation and what we like, what we don't like. James, you've probably got the furthest out of all of us. How are you finding it so far?
I'm 6 episodes in. I would say it has pretty much lived up to my expectations in that it's a slightly worse version of the comic in sort of terms of bringing the characters to life. I think this is something I'll save for when we, you know, do our Jessica Jones special or whatever, but I think Kristen Ritter's Jessica Jones is a different character from the comics version. And
yeah,
that,
absolutely.
That is preventing me from enjoying it maybe as much as some other people. I think it's worse than Daredevil in terms of its construction and writing, but it's also better than most of the TV series, so, you know, we're splitting hairs.
I would argue that it's, from what I've seen, and I'm 4 episodes in, so far it seems... it's not hitting the heights that some of Daredevil was, but I think it's probably more consistent at the moment. There's no kind of Foggy and Karen go off to investigate something that that our audience and hero have already investigated and you know, found out. I do like the more kind of, there has been a couple of 2 or 3 cases of the week, which is something that I was crying out for Daredevil to do, and this seems to be finding a good balance of telling little stories and little cases in an episode while also doing the overarching story stuff.
I think the main thing that's getting me excited for is the Luke Cage series, because Mike Coulter is amazing.
Yeah, really good.
He's so perfect as Luke Cage.
Really good. I've enjoyed every second he's been on the screen so far. And I also, I'm really enjoying the, like, I'm finding it tense, and I'm finding there's just a paranoia over everything that's going on.
They've nailed that, definitely.
Yeah. Seb, you haven't seen quite as much yet. What are your initial impressions? We'll let you off. You've got a young baby.
I mean, yeah, basically my wife didn't really like it from the first 20 minutes, so we stopped, and I will catch up, but I've only got, like, the first 20-odd minutes into it so far. So, you know, I should stress that any comments that I make are completely lacking in wider context. The problem I have with it so far, there's basically 2 main problems that I've had with it, which is one that, like Daredevil, the pacing is a real problem for me. I know that, you know, obviously there are people who get on with the kind of style of these shows and the way that they're paced because they sit there and you know, watch them through, but already at this early stage, I'm finding it a bit of a slog pace-wise. I look at that first 20 minutes and how much has happened in that first 20 minutes compared with how much happened in the first 20 minutes of Supergirl or The Flash. You know, and I know they're completely different shows, aiming in a completely different audience in a completely different way, but it's already feeling like it's dragging for me.
I would love a happy medium between the pace of Jessica Jones and The Flash, and Supergirl. Those two shows. Wow, one is sprinting, one is casually strolling down the street, looking over its shoulder every 5 seconds.
I mean, I was already aware that this wasn't really going to translate the things that I liked the most about Alias, because the things that I like most about Alias are the character of Jessica, and it was already clear that they were going for a different take, and that's fine. You know, you kind of, you know, could sort of put your own stamp on it. But the other thing that I love in Alias is the stories, and most of the stories that Alias does can't be done in this TV series. Like, I love the first arc of Alias, the Captain America conspiracy storyline. I think just, you know, really sets out well what that comic is doing and how the character fits in the Marvel Universe. And obviously that is not a story that this comic can, this TV show can do. And then I look through all the other storylines, and, you know, the probably the best story arc in the whole thing is the one that's about the girl who claims that she's a mutant and goes missing. You can't do mutants in this TV show, so you can't do that one either. You can't do the stuff with J. Jonah Jameson because he's a Spider-Man character. And it's just, and I think the problem with adapting Alias is you look at Daredevil and there's a lot of Daredevil. And there are a lot of different interpretations, and some are more popular than others, and the kind of Miller Bendis, and that's obviously what the TV show went for. But things like Mark Waid's run, and even the Mark Steven Johnson movie, have shown us that you can do, there's lots of Daredevil to draw on, and there's lots of different things you can do, and that means that you can get away with doing something that is new and your own take. And there's a lot about the Netflix Daredevil and the character and the way that he develops as Daredevil that is its own thing, and that's fine. Alias is like a 28-issue series that is a very particular set of stories, and this TV show doesn't adapt them, so it's kind of disappointing to me. But I did always kind of know that that was going to be the case. My other problem with it, really, is that it's really kind of a bit pervy. I mean, I don't know how much that develops after the opening
I found it just refreshingly adult, I wouldn't say pervy. I would say it's sexy. It's got some hot sex scenes, and they feel real for all the characters. And I thought refreshing for characters that would act in such a way.
Something that the comic never did was to go, here's Jessica Jones, look how great she looks in her pants. Whereas the TV show,
TV show does it in the first episode, but I think, to be fair, it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, well, and also I think
it does happen, it happens as much to Luke Cage as.
Yes, I was going to say very equal opportunity.
Does it have that scene in it? Because
not. Specifically, but there is a definite nod to that moment.
I was going to say, I said in my Den of Geek viewing notes is that they show you a bit more, and in doing that, leave less room for interpretation. So, and by being slightly more graphic, they actually made it a lot less, potentially graphic, if you get my meaning. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, but we are planning to get together to discuss Jessica Jones further, and we don't want to do it before we've all properly seen the whole thing, and we don't want to do it before most of you have finished watching the whole thing. So just stay tuned for that. But hopefully it won't be too long.
Might be a bit more upbeat than that conversation suggested.
Yes, I think
it does improve.
And I don't want to give the impression that there wasn't anything that I liked about it. Ritter, I really liked her and her performance and the character in those opening 20 minutes.
And fairness, Seb, I think my least favourite 20 minutes of the show so far were the first 20. I kind of watched them with a furrowed brow going, I'm not sure about this show yet. And then by the end of the first episode, I was like, okay, yeah, you've arced that really well. I'm on board.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Okay, we'll move on to our final piece of news now, and this relates to DC's Wonder Woman. We're going to see Wonder Woman first in Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. After that, we're going to see her in her own solo film before we see her in a two-part Justice League movie, and then possibly in sequels. DC, you've got it all planned out. But DC, after a little bit of a leak that I mentioned on last week's minisode, released a press release giving lots of details on the film, because it's now filming. Patty Jenkins is directing, and the press release has confirmed that, as well as Gal Gadot in the lead role, Chris Pine is starring, which we knew about. Robin Wright has joined the cast, Danny Houston, David Thewlis, Ewan Bremner, Saeed Tagmawi, who was the guy who made the leak, Elena Anaya, the Spanish actress who was in The Skin I Live In, and Lucy Davis, her off of The Office and Shaun of the Dead. We also know that it is being photographed by Matthew Jensen, who did Chronicle, Fantastic Four, various other people involved behind the scenes. So you can look at the press release. You don't want to hear about all that now. there was also one more still released of the film with Gal Gadot looking like Wonder Woman. And yeah, this film is happening. It's all going ahead. That cast sounds pretty exciting to me. We didn't get our Eva Green and Sean Bean, unfortunately, but it sounds like we got Robin Wright and Danny Houston instead.
You've got to imagine that Robin Wright is playing her mother. Oh no, because there was that. Oh, because there was Cersei, the villain, wasn't
yeah.
there? Yeah, yeah. I would have assumed from seeing Robin Wright's name that she'd be her mother, but yeah, and presumably Danny Houston is Ares. Yeah,
yeah.
Which, if he is, or I mean, it could be David Thewlis.
Who knows? And it looks like this is a period film from the picture that Saeed Taghmari tweeted or Instagrammed last week, which is, I think, what we were expecting, that this might be like a 1940s flashback to the wider world discovering Wonder Woman for the first time. There's also a rumour out there that Chris Pine is playing Steve Trevor here, but that he'll also be playing like a descendant of Steve Trevor in future movies. God. I don't know if that's true. That would be concerning.
Can we just take a moment to appreciate how good it was that the MCU didn't do that and just immediately have
Hayley Atwell there.
How did I forget Hayley Atwell's name? Let me start.
Because she's off Twitter, so you know, gone deleted.
didn't immediately have Hayley Atwell just playing Sharon Carter in the present day. But no, I mean this. I mean,
I like that cast.
It's an interesting looking cast, apart from Chris Pine, but Steve Trevor isn't interesting, and neither is Chris Pine. So,
I hope Chris Pine gets to be funny. Well, like Chris Pine is. Chris Pine was very funny in Into the Woods, and I quite liked his little cameo in Wet Hot American Summer. But yeah, I'm slightly worried. Although, wouldn't it be nice for Chris Pine just to be in this film as bland male love interest, in the way that so many women have been formed to play, have been cast to play bland love interest to male heroes along the way? I'd almost like that he is as bland as humanly possible.
But I do worry that the film might shift things more to his perspective. But, you know, if it's about the world encountering Wonder Woman for the first time, and like he seems to be dressed, because he's a pilot, isn't he? And it's like, you know, dressed in that old flying gear in that photo. Mm. And it's like, if we follow him as the character that maybe like crashes on Paradise Island and discovers the Amazonian society and stuff, it could actually take focus away from the fact that it's supposed to be a film about Wonder Woman.
Yeah, hopefully not.
The period idea is interesting. I would like it if it turns out that, you know, because it's weird, because Man of Steel never gave any impression that there had been any other superheroes. And then all of a sudden you've got Batman versus Superman establishing that Batman has been around for years and years. So if you're doing that anyway, then I quite like the idea that Wonder Woman could have been around since the 1940s and is, you know, still around in the present day, particularly if it means that she was basically the first superhero in this universe. I think that would be a nice twist.
Unless she kept herself to the Amazon before this point. You know, I imagine whenever we see Aquaman, he is going to have just been in the sea before then.
Dripping wet.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to this film. I'm intrigued to see a Wonder Woman movie, and I think there's hopefully a very big audience for it. Like, it's nice that it's actually happening. It's like, given the conversations we've had about Captain Marvel in the past couple of months, it's refreshing that Wonder Woman is in front of cameras and looks like it will be the next DC movie after Suicide Squad and Batman vs Superman.
I mean, I'm fully behind the idea of it, but one thing I would say is you're probably looking forward to it because you've never read a Wonder Woman comic.
Yeah,
but the problem with Wonder Woman is that, as a character, she doesn't have a lot going for her besides recognition. Like, there's, unless you're doing a sort of high Greek take, I don't think there's a lot to her.
I don't think that's necessarily a problem for this film, though, because I think that makes her a blank slate on which, if someone has come up with an interesting take, then go for it and don't worry about if it's different from how she's been in the comics.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for most people, I mean, because Wonder Woman has that cultural cachet in that people recognise her from the old Linda Carter version. except and that still remains fairly iconic, but no one is coming into it with really much baggage apart from that, and I don't think anyone's going to be coming in saying, oh, I can't believe they didn't stay true to that thing from the Wonder Woman TV show. I think it's just, hey, it's a Wonder Woman movie. That's interesting.
Well, it's like the Hulk. People only recognise the Hulk from the TV show. There had never been any good Hulk comics, and, you know, that worked.
Oh, fuck off.
I was just massively trolling James.
Jesus.
Okay, well, I think on that note, we'll draw our new section to a close, and we'll move on now to our spoiler-filled discussion of Kick-Ass. But before we dive in, let's listen to the original trailer for the movie.
I always wondered why nobody did it before me. I mean, all those comic books, movies, TV shows. You'd think the one eccentric loner would have made himself a costume. I mean, is everyday life really so exciting? Are schools and offices so thrilling that I'm the only one who ever fantasized about this? Come on, be honest with yourself. At some point in our lives, we all wanted to be a superhero. That's not me, by the way. That's some Armenian guy with a history of mental health problems. That's me.
How come nobody's ever tried to be a superhero? Dude, if anybody did it in real life, they'd get their ass kicked. They'd be dead in, like, a day.
Comic books had it wrong. You don't need a power to be a superhero.
Oh, yeah. Didn't see that, did ya?
Who are you? I'm Kick-Ass.
So you want to play?
Okay, so that was the trailer for Kick-Ass. We'll dive straight into our spoiler-filled discussion now. And guys, so I've watched Kick-Ass quite a few times over the years, and I assume, like me, both of you saw this for the first time in the cinemas. I only read the comic this week for the first time, Mark Millar's like first collection of Kick-Ass, the first graphic novel. Had you read it before you saw the film, or have you read it since, or like, because I know you both have kind of like complicated relationships with Mark Millar, right?
Oh, no, I think we both bought Kick-Ass like monthly as it was coming out, didn't we? Well, I don't know if it ended up all coming out monthly, but
because Mark Millar says very proudly that it all outsold Spider-Man. I mean, was huge, right?
That's such a very nebulous claim to make.
Yeah.
Which Spider-Man did it out, sir?
When and for how long?
Yeah. Yeah, he very much models himself on Stan Lee, with the exception that he has, and this is the biggest thing that you can say to Mark Millar's credit, he has a dogged insistence on making sure that artists are as equally compensated and in terms of ownership and profit from his work as he is.
Yeah.
And that's why,
to be fair, that's why he gets all the good artists.
I was going
to
say, that's why most of the best currently working artists in comics have drawn a creator-owned Mark Millar comic at some point, because he really, really values artists. And, you know, good on him for that. There's lots of things I can criticise him for, but I can't criticise him for that in the slightest. And that's why this is drawn by John Romita Jr.
But this was like a commercial hit, like out of the gates. Was it something that you liked? Did you stick with it the whole way through?
As Millar comics go, I liked it, because, and it's like, I don't think there's, I mean, there are quite a few Mark Millar comics that I like, but I don't think there are any that I like without reservation. And there are definitely reservations about Kick-Ass, but particularly when those first couple of issues came out, and Millar will obviously overstate how kind of original and revolutionary an idea it was to have a comic about an ordinary person in the real world inspired by comics deciding to be a superhero. Notwithstanding, those first two issues or so really were something quite distinctive, and it was a comic that, yeah, everyone was talking about at the time that it was coming out. And again, that was probably because Miller was blowing a lot of hot air about it, but it was a big hit of a series, and I remember buying it the way through to the end and enjoying it for the most part, definitely.
Yeah. So that's the Mark Millar side of it. Obviously, then you've got Matthew Vaughn directing. Now, we discussed Matthew Vaughn's follow-up to this film a couple of episodes back, which was X-Men First Class. But I find it very interesting, you know, how much Matthew Vaughn has been closely associated with superheroes. So we knew he was very close to directing X3. That ultimately didn't happen. He was also, the reason he was free to direct Kick-Ass or to look for his next project to develop was because he had been attached to Marvel's Thor for quite some time. Until that didn't come about, he kind of left the project and went and made Kick-Ass. So these two kind of, I would say, very confident, very sure of themselves, very, committed in their particular visions in terms of these two artists, but working in different mediums, kind of smashed together with Kick-Ass. And obviously, you know, 4 or 5 years later, we've now seen Kingsman. That's a relationship that's endured. But Matthew Vaughn comes to this with his own particular vision and kind of was developing this as Millar was still making the comic. It's that Scott Pilgrim situation all over again. Mm. And I wonder, do you think this is kind of a match made in heaven with these two?
I think, and I mean, also, you know, we kind of should, I think, mention Jane Goldman as well.
Yes, yeah.
Because if you look, I mean, I haven't seen Kingsman, but I've seen two films written by Jane Goldman and co-written by Matthew Vaughn and directed by Matthew Vaughn that improve on their source material, which are this and Stardust.
Mm.
And, you know, Vaughn and Goldman seem to have this ability to take a work that has good things about it, but that's flawed in other ways, and to keep the good things and, you know,
Stardust
and replace
as well. Notably, that's a Neil Gaiman book, so
yeah, exactly. It's a rare
resource material.
Exactly, it's one of Neil Gaiman's weaker works. It's still quite good, but it is one of his weaker works. But the film, I think the film is great, and you know, I think kind of the same here. I mean, yeah, something about Vaughn seems to click with Miller, like you say. You know, that relationship works well, but crucially, something about Vaughn and also Goldman is that they can click with the good bits of Miller's stuff. It's like if they were to make a film of Nemesis, which was a 4-issue Mark Miller series that was probably the most hyped thing he'd done since Kick-Ass, because it had the best one-line hook, which was, what if Batman was a supervillain? It's basically like, you know, in a world where there are no superheroes, there is one guy who dresses up in a costume and he's a villain and he fights cops.
Yeah.
Brilliant premise, brilliant first issue, train wreck of a subsequent 3 issues, and one of the worst endings to anything ever. And it's like I could see them doing a film of Nemesis that took that great hook and that great opening and made a good film out of it, because they can take the good stuff, but they know to leave out the stuff where Mark Miller just has his Mark Miller moments, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so I read the comic for the first time this week, and I have to say I do prefer the movie. I absolutely loved this movie after when I first saw it, and I think I've kind of cooled on it a little bit. I think quite a lot of the stuff that I liked about it was the stuff that like really grabs your attention the first time you see it, and I still have a lot of fun with this movie, but rewatching it and kind of zeroing in on little things, I was like, does that really all add up, or does that really go together, and what's the film trying to say here, and is, you know, is there some validity in that particular criticism or whatever? But I still did enjoy it a lot more than I did the comic, and obviously the comic has a lot of great stuff in it and a lot of great stuff that is retained for the film. But I think you're right, there are, and the film does retain, I think, some bad things about the comic as well. But generally I thought it was just, and this seems weird to say, almost a story that felt more, it felt like it. You could do more with it on film than you could on the page, and I think that that's not always the case. It sometimes feels that you're like condensing things down to do a film version of something. You often get that when there's actual novels, but this is an adaptation that fleshes out characters and lets ideas breathe and adds nuance to situation that's just not there on the page, and especially in the second half of the film. The graphic novel to me seemed to like just smash to a head in the final issue and end, whereas the film I think just has so much more breathing room.
There's a thing that people say, and I'm sure Mark Miller's probably said it, a lot of people have said it about comics in relation to film, which is that, you know, in comics basically there are no restrictions because your only restriction is the vision of the artist. And actually, the fact that there's no restrictions and that there are restrictions when you're making a film, I think is to the benefit of this film and to the detriment of the comic, because the comic all too often just goes for the ludicrously over the top with the violence and the gore and everything. And actually the fact that the film can certainly have moments and has got grisly moments, but by its very nature has to be more restrained with some of it and has to go and look somewhere else to do stuff in place of that.
Although the fact that it's able, the fact that it's able to do the stuff that it does do, and it does do an awful lot, and in fact I think it's an issue we'll get to later, is that was the kind of the stuff that the Daily Mail got angry about it for. I think a lot of that actually comes down to one scene that is entirely a film invention, but that was all able to happen because basically all of Hollywood said no to this. And so Matthew Vaughn went off and made this with his own production company, and Plan B, Brad Pitt's production company, was involved in some point as well. But basically, Matthew Vaughn made this outside of the system and then sold it back into Hollywood, basically. And so was able to do a lot of stuff that, I mean, no Hollywood film was going to have a movie with a 10-year-old girl dropping the C-bomb. You know, just like moments like, I imagine the microwave scene, which again is a film invention, would not be happening in any big studio movie. So the film kind of, while I think you're right, does kind of rein itself back in some regards, is also able to do more stuff than, I mean, like, in a lot of ways, this is a lot more violent and outrageous than Watchmen even.
But I think this gets away with a lot in terms of its violence. And actually, you mentioned the microwave scene, and I think that's a perfect example. This gets away with a lot in terms of its violence by having it be so completely slapstick and finding humour in the violence. Now, debate the moral rights and wrongs of finding humour in the violence, but almost every majorly violent scene has at least some comical element to it.
And I think that
enables the film to get away with.
And it's heavily, heavily stylized, and you've got Matthew Vaughn's very specifically chosen soundtrack playing over a lot of those kind of scenes as well. That gives it a certain feeling.
I mean, what you said about it, you know, it being able to be a film where a 10-year-old can drop the C-bomb. I mean, I've always thought this about this film. I really don't think this film would have been any worse off if it didn't have that moment. I actually think it adds anything.
The line delivery is really weak from Chloe Moretz as well. It's almost like the line. I think she's really great in this film. In fact, I think it's her best performance. I think it's Aaron Johnson's best performance. It might be Nick Cage's great late career performance. But that line really falls dead for a line that courted so much controversy. It feels like, were you only allowed to get her to read it once or twice on set? Could you not have reshot that a couple of times?
I mean, for me, the line that I think that about is more the one where she calls, I can't remember who it is, but she calls someone cocksuckers. And it's like, really? Like, that's your big shock moment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite so. I mean, the reaction to this film that we were talking before we started recording, there's, you know, you can go back and you can find five star reviews of this. There's a great one by Chris Hewitt in Empire. I think Peter Bradshaw gave this 5 stars. There were lots of very, very positive reviews. I think from both you guys as well, around the internet at the time and in print. But at the same time, there was also the Daily Mail reaction from Chris Tuckey, which was to say that this film, basically, I think the pull quote was, "Pedophiles are going to love it."
Problem with that Chris Tuckey review is that there are valid concerns about this film and about this film's portrayal of violence and of the, you know, putting that character in it that got completely buried under a totally nonsensical argument that nobody else in their right mind, it had even occurred to them, because there is absolutely no paedophilic gaze element in the way that Hit Girl is portrayed in this film, the way that Chris Tuckey interpreted it.
By all logical implication, paedophiles would not like a child that acted like an adult.
Well, I remember thinking that review said more about Chris Tuckey than it did about this
undoubtedly
film.
Yeah, I mean, but there was also, I mean, like, there was a lot of negativity from other critics. I think, James, you were mentioning how that kind of the UK reaction was generally, and Chris Tuckey aside, a lot stronger than the US reaction. I was reading a review from Karina Longworth and one from Roger Ebert, and Roger Ebert was kind of looking at the kind of moral angle and saying, that the target audience that this film would have, and seeing a young child engaging in such violence that it could be very easily copied. And I think Mark Millar's even said he would love to inspire like real life superheroes through this kind of thing. And then there's the other side of the coin where there are people saying it's just like puerile and immature, and it thinks it's being clever, and it, and so, you know, when you're saying, James, about like the cocksucker line, you're like, really? I think there are those moments. I think it's very easy for people who don't like this film and don't buy in to just go, oh, come on. I mean, Kingsman got exactly that same reaction. Like, there's people falling about themselves laughing on the final line of Kingsman, and there are other people walking out of the cinema just shaking their heads going, that's the best you can do? That's humour, is it?
I have more time for people who think it's puerile than people who get sort of morally outraged by it, because like it's so cartoonish that I don't think rating systems being what they are, no one who should be affected by this film should see it.
And I would agree with that. I find it very hard to buy into that whole moralistic argument.
You know, if you think its sense of humour is stupid, that's different. Like I can accept that argument completely.
But actually, I really think, and because I said this in my review at the time, I think it's got a far stronger moral sense about it than people give it credit for. In fact, the moral heart of it is one of the main things that it adds that isn't there in the comic, really. Mm. Although the line that sums it up is, to be fair, a line from the comic. It's just that I don't think the comic successfully carries through on the character of Dave. I think Dave is a terrible character in the comic, whereas I think he's a much better drawn character here. Mm. But the line, and it is a bit of a hokey line, but why does everybody want to be Paris Hilton and nobody wants to be Spider-Man?
Yeah.
And just that core thing of, hang on a minute, it would kind of be the right thing to do to help people. That is just basically the message of the film. And the scene that really nails it is the first time he goes... Well, not the first time he goes out, because the first time he goes out, you know, he gets the horrific accident. But the first time he goes out after the accident, and that guy outside the convenience store, and the guys are beating him up, and he doesn't back down. And just that moment when he's just looking defiantly down the guy's camera phone... And it's just, you know, there's nothing in it for him other than that he's decided that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, there is an element of he thinks it'd be pretty cool to be a superhero, sure. But basically, he thinks it'd be cool to be a superhero because what superheroes do is help people. Mm. And, you know, okay, it's wrapped up in a film that has a 10-year-old swearing and chopping people's heads off and a load of cartoonish violence. But basically, that's the centre of the film. And that's a really good moral message.
I mean, I would massively agree with that. And I actually think that is a really wonderful moment and one of the standout moments in the film. And you're right, in the adaptation. Now, I kind of want to talk through an issue that I had with this film on a rewatch, because it's something that hadn't really occurred to me before. And like I said, that there are some kind of things that morally I look at this film and kind of, like, raise my eyebrow at. I don't quite buy into all of those arguments, you know, you were talking about it influencing kids and it being, you know, and it being problematic in those kind of ways. But the message of the film, and I just find... totally hoping that you're going to explain this to me and tell me why I'm wrong. But at its heart, is this a movie where a kid goes, I want to be Spider-Man, and these other two characters go, no, you should be the Punisher. And by the end of the film, he's gone, yeah, I should be the Punisher. Oh, cool, look, here's a bazooka. Like that, I found it really strange that and it only occurred to me this time that you've got these two dueling ideologies of what it is to be a superhero and the kind of superhero you can be, and ultimately it's the kind of brutal vigilantes that convince this kid to join their way of thinking.
Specifically the bazooka moment, I can see what you're getting at.
Well, and there is also the minigun moment, like, 5 minutes before.
I consider that part of the same thing, really, because it's the bazooka and the minigun, you know, the jetpack thing and stuff, yeah. But I think up to that point, like, most of the stuff that goes wrong because of Hit Girl and Big Daddy's approach. And Big Daddy dies as a result of it. And so he's essentially punished for his approach. And I think that while okay, you know, the film does end with him killing the bad guy. But that does happen in superhero things. You know, there are certain superheroes who aren't supposed to kill the bad guy. But there are a lot of superheroes who do, not just the Punisher. And I think actually the film ends on this note of Dave having shown Hit Girl that their way isn't the only way to save the day. And, you know, you can't get much more symbolic than flying off on a jetpack, basically Superman style, you know, and knowing that Mark Miller is as big a fan of Superman as he is as well. I mean, I know Mark Miller is pretty cynical in his comics, but he is also a pretty big fan of Superman. Mm. And so I think it's more, if anything, about pretty much finding that balance between the two approaches that you tend to find in superhero comics.
Okay.
I don't know if it says that one is more right than the other, because I think both are shown to be wrong in their way. So, yeah. I don't know what you think, James.
Yeah, I do. I do think, like, the issue of, you know, there are criminals who have been, you know, abandoned by society or whatever, and Hit Girl and Big Daddy are killing them with their shitloads of money. Like, well, you know, there are problems there, and I think the debate about whether heroes should kill is one that could have been explored within the bounds of this film and isn't.
Yeah, I mean, there was a moment listening to the Matthew Vaughn commentary for this film that kind of made me raise an eyebrow as well. He was talking about the scene when Hit Girl does go into that kind of crack den and slice and dice everyone in there. And so the implication is that there are a lot of, you know, bad dudes in there, and that the main guy, I think it's Razul, and the rest of his crew are kind of like, you know, they're bad guys. They're affiliated with our, you know, main villainous organization, Frank D'Amico's kind of crime syndicate.
Yeah.
But there's one guy in there, and Matthew Vaughn says, like, oh, and people always give me stick for this. So they see this, and there's just this one guy getting high. So he's not part of the group. He's just there getting high. And they're always like, oh, you know, it's not really fair that you killed this guy. And it's like, well, you know, he's a druggie, he's probably done some bad stuff, and, like, you don't know, he could have robbed places, and he could have stolen, and he could have... So, like, he probably deserves it. And I'm like, whoa! is that really the message of this film?
Which is interesting, because, like, yeah, I'd always kind of taken it that... I mean, I think Hit Girl, you have to look at Hit Girl as a separate case, because I think there's a genuine case to be made that because of her age and because of her upbringing, you can't hold Hit Girl herself culpable for anything she does in the film. I think the way I've always looked at it is that Big Daddy is written as a far less sympathetic character than he actually comes across in the film. And the reason he comes across as so sympathetic is because of the way Nick Cage plays him.
Yeah, and there's also one fundamental change to his narrative from the comic to the movie, which is that in the comic, the whole backstory that Big Daddy gives in the film is a lie, and that in fact he's kidnapped Mindy from her mother. And really, really unpleasant like twist to discover at that moment in the comic.
I remember reading that comic, obviously, as it was coming out, as we talked about before. And actually, I think I even remember having a conversation with James about that twist. Because I remember when reading that comic when it was coming out, thinking that that was such a brilliant twist. And that was actually one of the best things Miller had done in a while. It was just a twist you just did not see coming. It just came out of nowhere and was a really great twist.
I mean, it does. I kind of hated it, though.
Well, thing is, in the film, it would not make any sense for that to happen, and it's completely right that the film doesn't have that twist. And then I went back and reread the comic recently in preparation for this podcast, and I got to that moment, and I was like, well, I remember this being feeling like a really good twist at the time, but now that I look at it, it makes no logical sense in the overall context, and it also makes absolutely no thematic sense whatsoever. It's only there to be a cool twist. And
yeah, I can tell you, Matthew Vaughn did not care for it at all.
To be fair, like the point of it is to say, like, Big Daddy is just like Dave, like he's just a comic nerd. Like I can see why it's in there.
I mean, that comes across in the film as well, though.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think it should have been in the film, because especially when you've got him drawing the comic pages, like, you don't need it.
Yeah.
But I really liked that sequence.
I know, that's what I mean, I like that sequence.
Oh,
But you don't need the reveal that Big Daddy is a comic nerd by his briefcase spilling open and being filled with, like, Silver Age stuff or whatever it was. Like, you don't need that moment, because that part of the character has already been translated.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In other means.
Yeah, in the film it is just that he does have money. I think Mindy makes some reference at some point that, like, oh, we've, you know, got $3 million in cash in a suitcase or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how they can afford the jetpack and all that kind of stuff.
I
think that comes across pretty well. So one of the other things that relates to that kind of stuff is that, I mean, obviously we talked about how All the violence and all that kind of stuff, kind of, you know, we don't have a problem with it because it takes place in this very obviously stylized world. Now, what I found a little bit confusing is that this is a film and a comic that kind of prides itself on this is how you could become a superhero in the real world, and this is like, what if a kid really did try and be Spider-Man? And yet it doesn't take place in anything resembling the real world. Yes, its villains are mobsters, and yes, technically everything in this film could happen in the laws of physics, I guess. But the comic and the movie are hyper, hyper stylized. This is this is definitively a comic book world. Mm. Like, even Dave's stabbing, like, I think Matthew Vaughn said that, you know, there was the temptation to shoot that in a really kind of gritty, like, realistic way, and he was like, no, that wouldn't be the right way to go. And I think he's completely right, but it is this weird kind of like clash of ideas of what if this was in the real world, except it's not.
I mean,
has that ever been a problem for you?
When people say that, like, something is what if you had superheroes in the real world? It never is. I've seen Watchmen described as what if there, so many times described as what if there were superheroes in the real world. What real world is Watchmen set?
Alternate 1985.
And yeah, this is this. I mean, it does a similar thing to the comic, which is that it starts out purporting to be that, and I think actually it's a quite successful narrative collapse, because you have that dialogue where he says, you know, oh, you know, if no one would do it in real life because they'd just get their ass kicked, and obviously that does happen to
him. Yeah.
But then everything after that point is, it's, but the film basically acknowledges within about its first 15 minutes, no, this couldn't happen in reality, so we're not going to show you it happening.
Well, it is
reality.
Kind of,
we're
it is almost that moment, isn't it?
Well, this is
it's after he gets stabbed, it's kind of like the film devolves into
Jacob's ladder.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is almost like he dies and the rest of the film is a fever dream.
Yeah, like, I remember when issue one of this came out, it ended with him sort of broken and beaten on the on the ground after being hit by a car. And it's kind of like, there's your superheroes in the real world take.
Yeah, that's where that battered. Take ends.
Yeah, and then issue two onwards is, let's have fun with that.
Yeah.
You know, well, I mean, so we immediately get, don't we? Okay, he's had metal plates put in his head, and he's got metal on lots of the different parts of his body that makes him kind of like look like Wolverine on an X-ray, and his nerve endings have been damaged, so he can't feel pain like other people. And it's like, okay, well, at this point, you have given him a superpower.
Yeah, exactly.
it's like a higher tolerance for pain, but that's it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's something I think the film and comic both did. Like, they pursued the point up to the maximum possible
natural
extension
end point.
Of it.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I love those first kind of, like, 10-15 minutes. I mean, when essentially it's just a story of how one kid who is going to be Quicksilver and his friend who is going to grow up to be Quicksilver, they and their other friend who is going to get
he's
a job on the
fake
office.
Dwight from the office.
Yeah, they're just hanging around and being kids, and like they're nerds, and they go to comic shops, and they like get mugged by bullies, and I mean the whole like introductory monologue from Aaron Johnson, who I really do think is like he has this kind of weird crass charisma to him in this film, in that like. You kind of think this kid is a bit of a dick and a douche, but you can't help but love him. And I don't think Aaron Johnson has effectively managed to do that very often. He does it so well here. And the monologue about looking at his teacher's boobs and masturbating and then masturbating again, and the really great cut to, you know, this is not going to be the "I will avenge you, mother" story. I mean, it's verbatim almost taken from the comic, but that sequence on both the page and in the film is incredible. Kind of, yeah, maybe it doesn't end up being that film. End up being that comic, but it's fantastic.
I mean, I'm on Johnson. I mean, I mentioned this before, that just in the comic, like, Dave is just an awful character. He's just an arsehole. He really is. No sympathy for him. And the thing that worries me in the comic is that I think Mark Miller thinks that he's a likable character, and it's a problem that, again, I feel like we're ragging on Miller all the time, because there are good things about Mark Miller's comics as well, but I don't think he knows how to write a likable character as well as he thinks he does. And I think Dave is supposed to be likable in the comic, and he really isn't. In this, I mean, yeah, he does have that sense of he's a bit of a dick, but he's a bit of a dick in the way that all teenage boys are a bit of a dick.
And I mean, I like he kind of just has these goofy little smirks to his friends. And
no, it's a really engaging performance. It's like, I mean, I think generally in real life, it seems like Aaron Johnson is a bit of a dick. But between this and Age of Ultron, he does seem to play characters who, you know, are kind of a bit of a dick, but you sort of like anyway. I think he's got that cornered quite well.
Did you like Quicksilver?
Yeah. In Age of Ultron, I thought Quicksilver was great.
I felt about him
because I thought he was
a bit
of a dick. But yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, so I really like all that in introductory stuff. So obviously that this then, okay, it is purporting to be real world superhero and kind of changes tack. The comic certainly goes a lot into like riffing on the idea of like comic book culture. You know, these are comic book nerds who are influenced by the superheroes that they're reading about, and you know, I spotted like they're reading, you know, particular comics in the film. I saw Runaways pop up at one point, and they're referencing different arcs from different comics and talking about different things. And I think the movie kind of does that as well. It seems to have this riffing on comic book culture by the nature of the story, but is able to double down on that by doing comic book movie and TV references. And in a way, it's kind of like the perfect text for this podcast, because it kind of flits between the both of those. I mean, most obviously in Nicolas Cage's affectation, which... we need to talk about it. It's wonderful. It was, yeah, Nicolas Cage's idea, and apparently the producers were very sceptical, and Matthew Vaughn convinced them that, no, Cage was onto a winner here. I think it splits people. What do you guys think of it?
No, it's such it's a perfect fantastic idea. Yeah, yeah. Like, really, why wouldn't you do that if
we should,
when
we should say
came up?
Nick Cage is wearing a costume that is very Batman-esque in that it is not in the comics.
It's very Batman Begins Batman specifically as well.
Yes, yeah. But is doing the Adam West Batman voice. but only when he's in the...
Yeah, when he's in costume.
Yeah,
and only when he's in front of other people as well.
Yeah, true. It's great. It's just, it does, it, it's, it gets, I mean, you talked before about, you know, you've got the scene where he's drawing the art that gets across that he's an old comic book nerd, but actually this gets it across as well. And it's like, mm-hmm, yeah, this is a guy who, on the one hand, he is, you know, a complete psychopath vigilante, but on the other hand,
completely
vigilante
crazy,
who wants to be Batman. It's just that's, yeah, and the way that he decides
he wants to be all versions of Batman.
Yeah. And it kind of makes sense that he has kind of like, he has a screw loose because this thing in his past did actually happen to him. You know, his wife was killed, and, you know, he was, or his wife died, and he was, you know, in prison, and, you know, he was unable to raise his daughter for the first couple of years. And you can see kind of like that this is a guy who... something has snapped and not everything is quite right with him. And Nicolas Cage... he just gets that. I mean, like, we talked about in the Ghost Rider podcast and how he has these like little quirks that he brings to a character, but they're all completely thought out. They're not just plucked out of the ether to be just like Nicolas Cage being a bit wacky again. It all makes sense for this character, and I just thought you get such a stronger sense of who this guy is in the movie than you ever do in the comics. And obviously it ends up being a different character anyway.
One of my favourite moments is when they're tooling up for, you know, the kind of the last battle kind of thing. God. And you see him putting on his mask and he's
makeup.
Painting on,
yeah,
the black makeup. Oh. You get it's in superhero
wonderful
movies.
Yeah.
See, the Cage thing that always comes out for me is when he's tied to the chair and he's on fire and he's shouting instructions to Hit Girl. Like, you just can't imagine any other actor making that work.
That is wonderful, because, I mean, like, so he's dying in front of his child and is in immense pain because he's burning alive, but is singularly focused on saving his daughter's life. But saving his daughter's life involves murdering a whole bunch of people who have them held captive. And I wouldn't even like to attempt the line delivery that Nicolas Cage gives. It is completely bonkers. But I think that is my favourite part of the movie.
It's definitely up there.
It's, yeah. And I mean, that's all happening just after we've seen this kind of, like, horrendous scene play out with the two of them being beaten up. And yeah, the whole kind of twisted nature of it, that this is him getting his daughter to murder people ruthlessly. Oh, it's just, yeah. absolutely wonderful. Some of the other comic book stuff that it riffs on, I mean, not just what Nicolas Cage does. I mean, we get Henry Jackman's score has, you know, especially in, you know, the opening moments, you can feel the John Williams vibe to it. It feels very Superman-y.
I was about to say.
Not test screenings, but James and I think, yeah, we were at different screenings, but the previous screenings that we saw to review it, the score wasn't complete. And so the start of the film did actually use the Superman theme.
Amazing.
And I think they also use Superman for the bit where he's got the costume and he's trying the costume
on. Yeah, that's the bit where I remember it from.
Yeah, and they used Danny Elfman's Batman for the bits with the car. Bizarrely, the final bit where they're flying off on the jetpack used All Around the World by Oasis.
Well, I think you know, Danny Elfman actually does contribute some music to this, and Henry Jackman, like I say, it's specifically John Williams influenced. There's another moment where Kick-Ass rips open his shirt for the first time to kind of, and you can see the scuba suit underneath, and it is pretty much Christopher Reeve. Like, it is Christopher, it's the same shot, basically. And he does the same thing on the roof when Kick-Ass is running. When he's running to jump over the roof,
yeah.
Matthew Vaughn specifically uses the same shots that Sam Raimi used for Tobey Maguire jumping across the roof in Spider-Man.
When I was watching that, I was like, this is so similar. It must have been a direct riff. And yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
I do like that bit when he gets to the edge of the building and stops and just basically goes, fucking hell no. And you've also got I mean, it's a really obvious one, but the reference right at the end, I do like the last line. That's...
wait till they get a load of me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obvious, but I like it.
Yeah. I think that is one of the things that I think the movie is really successful in doing, and why I kind of think that almost the movie is a better medium for this story than the page, is because we do have a movie and TV world that is so steeped in superheroes at this point.
There's a vernacular that you can draw on and you can, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think as well, I mean, you talked about stuff like that Spider-Man scene. It never really spoofs, though. And I think that's good. It's drawing on all of this stuff, and it's drawing on the idea that you'll recognise this stuff. But it never goes into just parodying it. And I think that's an important distinction that it makes. It's, you know, it does call all of this stuff to mind, but it's not a Friedberg and Seltzer version of a superhero movie.
I mean, I was wondering when I was watching this was what the film ultimately was trying to say and what it was actually aiming to do. Is it a film that's just trying to do a pretty simple, look, we've come up with our own superhero, we're going to tell this fun story, except we're not going to be held back by kind of like, you know, any sense of like decency. These are the rules we should adhere to. We're just going to go out there, throw everything at it and have a load of fun. Or whether it actually has anything to say, because you're right, I don't feel like it's spoofing, and I don't feel like it's like really trying to directly homage. More than it is just trying to be, this is what films in this genre are, and we're going to tell a slightly different story within it. But I couldn't tell whether the film was trying to say anything specific, and I wonder whether that is like what holds it back ultimately from being something really great. Whether it doesn't seem to have anything that is going, look, this is what we want you to take away from this about comic books and about comic book movies. I think maybe ultimately, despite the fact that it's coming from a different direction, it does end up just being another really well realized, really well executed comic book movie. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is sort of a hint of subtext there in that at the end of the film, other people are inspired by his actions to go out and do good themselves. And I think if there's any message to it, it is that first action scene, second action scene, sort of, you know, help people and don't back down from it. Sort of, because, you know, aside from the ending, that's the big moment of, you know, where you're punching the air in sort of glee, is that he's, you know, he's doing what he set out to do in helping people. So I think if there's anything, it's that. But I also agree that it's not particularly heavy. You know, it doesn't go very deep on it.
No, I think that just, like, almost the trappings of it might suggest to you that this is a film with pretensions to say something more than it ever really does. And I think that might have wrong-footed some critics at the time, in that they were expecting some kind of massive, like, takedown of the genre or real subversion of it. And really what it does is it kind of just really glories in doing making, like, tweaks on the various different tropes and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's got all the same beats as a Marvel movie, essentially, hasn't it?
I just think that Matthew Vaughn, I think he's created a greater overall product here, but I'm not sure that I'd, like, want to give him credit for, like, everything he adds to this is better. I think I would like to temper it somewhat.
I mean, I can see why it's done that way, but the romance plot...
I was about to say, if anything, if this movie gets anything wrong from the adaptation, it's the scene where, having lied to her and, you know, killed that guy, or, you know, helped that guy die and stuff, like, after admitting all that, she, like, jumped his bones. Like, I remember watching that in the cinema and thinking, okay, when are they going to reveal that this is all some kind of masturbatory fantasy? And they never did.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably another film that, you know, it's getting boring, doesn't probably do a great job by its female characters. I mean, because Katie is just, yeah, you're right. In the comic, she reacts to finding out that he'd been pretending to be gay the whole time by basically hitting him and then,
getting a boyfriend to beat him up.
Yeah, and then sending him a video or a picture that's made me go, this is the kind of Mark Millar stuff that I imagine most people raise their eyebrows at. But yeah, she just, in the movie, she doubles down, and now this, and this is kind of, it's like this nerd fantasy where now the hottest, like, most socially conscious, good, all-round great girl now also wants to have sex with him all the time in public whenever he wants. Basically, it's a very strange decision. And then, so she also has a friend that's pretty much, her role is in some ways you could say beefed up for the movie, because she kind of becomes the love interest of Clark Duke. But also, I don't think she ever speaks. I don't think she ever says a word. I think she just kind of looks at Clark Duke, like, terrified, or like, oh, what's going on here? Or, oh, hey, I like
you.
She does.
I think she says something like, they say, where's Katie? And she says, with Dave, why else would I be here? Or something. Like, right. That's basically her only line.
I mean, and that goes back to, that was another one of the problems that the people kind of who were complaining about the sexualization of Hit Girl. So we get Clark Duke has copped off with Katie's friend, and Kick-Ass and Dave is with Katie. And then the third character, the Evan Peters character, he kind of is watching Hit Girl when she is doing that, like, badass thing on the internet and goes, oh my god, she's amazing, I want to marry her. And the other guy goes, dude, she's like 10. And he goes, I don't care, I'll wait for her. Which, to me, I always read as a kind of, like, yeah, I'm not sexually attracted to her. It's just whoever that person is so fucking awesome that when she is 16, I would be interested.
I remember 18. Chris Tucky quoting that line. I remember him quoting the line, I think I'm in love with her, dude, she's about 10, and not quoting the follow-up line, which was, I don't care, I'll wait. And it's like, you have actually removed the context in order to make that sound far worse than it is. It's a gag. Yeah. And it's not... Yeah, it's...
I have to say, I really...
The Daily Mail is looking for moral outrage anyway.
I really like those two. I like Clark Duke and Evan Peters. They almost discovered for this film. And I think they're both... I less so this time, weirdly, but I wonder whether it was just that I'd been so charmed by them the first time around that they seemed like the goofy kind of friend kids, almost like the American equivalent of the, like, mates that Will has in The Inbetweeners. you know, that they're kind of his mates, but they're taking the piss out of him all the time, and that they're just as nerdy and dumb as he is. And I just found myself really charmed by those two. And, you know, I can see why they are still, you know, two guys who are showing up in studio movies and are in demand, and why one of them probably correctly thought that it wasn't a wise decision to return for the sequel.
Just quickly, I want to say, of the ensemble, though, I think Christopher Mintz-Plasse is probably the, you know, the big piece of the puzzle that we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, so
talked about Chloe Moretz either, but yeah.
I guess we barely even mentioned Red Mist as a character, and the whole mob side of things as well. Let's start with Red Mist and kind of address that side of the movie, the villain side. Does Mintz-Plasse work for you? Because he's a big departure from the Red Mist on the page.
I think it's a way in which the film, again, drastically improves on the comic. I think, well, it sort of does two things. It's sort of, on the one hand, we know much earlier in the film than we do in the comic that he's a bad guy. But on the other hand, even though we know at the start that he's on the side of the bad guys, we like him much more in the film than in the comic. Because again, in the comic, he's just unpleasant. Whereas in this, again, he's just a massive nerd. And actually, I like that. Okay, you know, he does eventually kind of turn out to be the villain, and he is someone who, on the one hand, wants to sort of take over his dad's criminal empire because he thinks it's cool, but also he's a massive nerd, and he just kind of wants to be a superhero as well. And his way of becoming a superhero is to pretend to be one in order to entrap Kick-Ass. But actually, he enjoys the being a superhero.
Yeah, this is
as much. You know, it's like it's the trap is a pretext for him to get all that cool stuff and do that.
It's a different character on the page, isn't it? The character on the page is just pure evil. He's like a mini version of his dad. I think he actually says something like about how, like, seeing Dave getting beaten up actually turns him on or something. The character on the page, yes, he wants to impress his dad and get rid of, you know, Hit Girl and Big Daddy for him, but he actually sees Dave as someone who would be his friend and kind of thinks that he's really cool because he's just another comic book nerd like him who wanted to dress up like a superhero.
Yeah,
like, and I don't think you can play down the Christopher Mintz-Plasse casting in that this comes 2 or 3 years after Superbad, where Chris Mintz-Plasse at that stage, if he isn't still now, was basically just McLovin. And the only, like, really notable role that he'd had between that and Kick-Ass was in Role Models, where he basically played another kind of, like, massive nerdy kid. But basically, he was McLovin. And when McLovin shows up like that, I think a lot of the audience, which I think Superbad and Kick-Ass probably had a lot of audience crossover, were just like, ah, it's McLovin. It wasn't Chris Mintz-Plasse, it was McLovin.
Yeah.
And you're right, there is this kind of immediately, you are kind of drawn to him.
I love their shit fight at the end as well. I really like that.
It's the perfect. Well, I love the moment when they're in the Mistmobile and they're listening to, is it Gnarls Barkley, and just kind of like nodding along and kind of like doing dumb little dance moves with each other. I thought it was quite kind of like a sweet friendship. And you're right. I think in that regard, really does improve on the idea of that character from the comic. I did still find it difficult to buy Chris Mintz-Plasse at certain moments. I think he's probably improved as an actor since then. I'm not sure he is the best actor amongst this group.
Maybe not the best actor, but I think he's the best comic. The thing I like about the film version is that he's kind of not a mature person. Like, he's got those kind of daddy issues, and he's really hoping to be treated like an adult but not getting that respect that he thinks he deserves.
He just really wants to impress somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like first his dad and then Kick-Ass,
and he doesn't really care who from. Like, and I think that's something that I know we shouldn't be talking about the sequel, but him in the sequel is like that character thread continues, and that's one of the things I like about the sequel. And also, yeah, sorry, another point I was going to make is that even though he's trying to be evil, like, he still pulls Kick-Ass out of a burning warehouse.
Yeah. Like, I think it's just it's another one of those cases where the movie is just able to, with a little bit more room, do a lot more stuff for a character to make them seem like a real human being and not just a caricature. And yes, this all does take place in this ridiculous stylized comic book world, but I think mostly, and I think it's a little bit more difficult for Hit Girl and Big Daddy, but I think mostly for everyone else, they do kind of feel like real people. They do kind of, I get a sense of them all as human beings, and that extends to Frank, and it extends to Dave's dad, and even some of the goons in the organisation.
I was going to say with Frank, I mean, I love Mark Strong anyway, but he is mostly this relentless stereotype, but what I like about him is just like the exasperation, because he's just got this sense throughout of, I can't believe these ridiculous people in these stupid costumes. And the bit when he gets out of the car and shoots the Kick-Ass impersonator.
It's the reveal, so isn't it? Where he's like, you know, who has a Kick-Ass impersonator at their party? Like, it's just so perfect.
And at the moment, there's the moment where him and Chris Mintz-Plasse are in the car together, when you can still hear the goon who's been tortured and killed inside screaming, and he's talking about what they're going to order when they get to the cinema. And there's more riffing really there well on judged, superhero stuff when they get to the cinema. There's the Spirit 3 is the film that is that is up on the billboard. I thought that was a fun little dig right there. what did you think about the mob, because again, they didn't feel like a real mob to me. this didn't feel like Mindy.
It's Dexter
and
Fletcher and Jason Fleming.
Yeah, well, there's that. You know. But it didn't feel like they were taking down, you know, like the Sopranos or anything like that. this was again, these are the villains that you have to have in a kind of pared down, this takes place in the real world, you know, our super villain is not going to be, you know, like I don't know, Magneto or someone like that, but it's mobsters. But yeah, they're an absolute cartoon of an organization. They're always hanging out in this one warehouse, and we have Dexter Fletcher and Jason Fleming, and I think Matthew Vaughn does find lots of fun, grisly ways to dispatch them all. It's really quite nasty, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the way it kind of bursts like a balloon that had me laughing.
Oh, the Dexter in the car.
Yeah.
The car that he drives away from Layer Cake, actually. He drives away in that car from Layer Cake, and then maybe it's the same character turning up and getting squashed here. Jason Fleming gets shot through the cheek. We have that other guy in the microwave. I think there's such a like brazen confidence to everything that Matthew Vaughn does with that stuff, and like I say, obviously intersects with Mark Millar as well. That I just buy it. I mean, even if it doesn't always sit comfortably with me, and I do kind of think ideologically, I'm not quite sure whether me and Matthew Vaughn would be on the same page if we discussed like the morals of this movie or, like, you know, the kind of the rights and wrongs of how certain characters act. But you can't help but admire just how, like, swashbuckling he is in his approach to all of this. It's just that there's just a huge sense of fun. And I think that explains why there were so many 5-star reviews of this at the time. Because for me, it's not a 5-star film. It's probably a solid 4. But it's, you can't help, I mean, unless you are morally outraged by it, I think it's hard not to get swept up in the fun of it all. And I kind of had that same sense with Kingsman, where Kingsman, there's a lot of stuff that I kind of go like, did you have to? And, I don't really like that. But also I'll find myself just kind of forgetting about what the movie's saying for a minute or how it's saying it, and just go, oh God, that scene is absurd. And just laughing along with it and having a great time. And I think he definitely gets that. He gets that in a lot of the action scenes. I mean, some of the music that he uses to score this. I mean, so we get the particularly the music that always stands out to me is the music that plays when Mindy is taking out all of the goons in that room for the first time. But I mean, as always, you guys are probably better versed than me in talking about the merits of a soundtrack.
Like, the thing I think works about the soundtrack is that it's got that kind of mixtape quality. Like, the music is so... It's so, like, up front in pretty much all the major scenes.
That, I actually... I mean, that Prodigy track is a pretty famous pre-existing track of theirs, mm-hmm. and I can't dis... As far as I'm concerned, when I hear that, it's the theme from Kick-Ass.
Yeah,
I can't disassociate
now,
it from Kick-Ass. Mm. Yeah.
What else is on there? I mean, obviously, it's got the kind of cartoonish Hit Girl stuff.
And there's obviously the big Elvis moment at the end. I think that's almost the moment that whenever I'm watching this just stands out to me so much, in that it's just this ridiculously overblown. Like I say, I don't like the very idea that Dave is there with these miniguns blowing people to pieces.
But it's so
it's such a like balls on the table moment, going, look at what our film is doing. We are, like, playing Elvis Presley in an absurd manner right now, and watching this superhero in a scuba costume flying through the air on a jetpack, gunning down people in a room, and a couple of minutes later, he is going to be getting out a bazooka to shoot someone into the sky. I feel like, in a way, this discussion we've had kind of started out like with themes and ideas about the movie and the translation, and we kind of just moved towards a lot of moments that we like. And in a way, I think that's probably appropriate. Like, I think there is just... I think I walk away from this film ultimately just going, that was fun, and that was fun, and that was fun, and I enjoyed that, and I had a good time with that. And... yeah.
And we haven't even talked about the Big Daddy scene. Like, this is the thing. It's a film that's got so many of these moments that we can pick up that we haven't even got around to talking about the best one.
Go straight into it, Seb.
Well, it's just... It's an astonishingly good scene. That one take... I mean, I don't know if it is one take or if it's a fake one take, but the security camera footage of Big Daddy taking out the warehouse is just a supremely well-directed action sequence. It's just... I could just watch that over and over again.
You see, what's so good about that is why I let you say what it was, because I didn't know what you were talking about. Not that scene isn't just a fantastically choreographed, like, really well-realised idea, the way that it kind of, like, moves from the security camera footage to showing the whole thing in this kind of, like, sweeping camera movement. There's, like, a real grace to it, and then back out again to them watching it on the TV and this nonplussed look on Mark Strong's face. It is fantastic. But for me, you could quite have easily been talking about the first time we meet Hit Girl and Big Daddy, and he's shooting her in the mm-hmm. in the park, which, again, we haven't talked about. But when you see that scene for the first time, you're like, you're meeting these two characters for the first time with a little comic book meanwhile showing up on the screen. And it's just, I mean, like, as an introduction to two characters, you're like, I think even in Roger Ebert's scathing review of this movie, even he was like, no one could have sold that scene like Nicolas Cage could. There's so many of them.
My only reservation with that scene is, while it's a lovely, great little scene, it's very similar to some stuff in Preacher. Like, it's not entirely the same,
right.
But the whole thing with the kindly dad teaching his little girl to shoot guns when she's far too young is almost a direct lift from a particular issue of Preacher. So that's maybe my only concern with that. I mean, the film plays it differently, and Nick Cage is great. I like the scene where they're having the chat afterwards at the ice cream place. But
it's the look on his face when she says she wants a puppy.
Okay, well, I mean, so there's so many of those moments that we talked about that we like so much. But, I mean, I think what a lot of it comes down to is, yes, there is that confidence from everyone involved, but that does extend to the cast too. And I think probably the cast member that personifies that the most is Chloe Moretz, because it bears remembering that, yes, Chloe Moretz is older now. She was actually, like, 10 years old when she was filming this, and was kind of at the centre of this, like, controversy around her character. She is very, very good at doing all of that, like, cool, like, old enough, acting like an adult as this superhero, but also having this childlike innocence and this naivety, but that the kind of that the character doesn't even realise that she has. Like, it's almost like it's the most cartoonish scene is when she's playing up being a child, when she's dressed up as the schoolgirl. And that's very strange to think about. It's a very, very accomplished performance from Chloe Moretz. And I think it's, it's what really pays testament to that is that many of the negative reviews of the film still went, yes, I hate everything about this Hit Girl character, but the young actress Chloe Moretz is really good.
The surprising thing is kind of that she's how little a part of the film she is. I mean, she is a reasonably major part of the film, but in terms of screen time, you know, she's not in it that much more than Big Daddy is. In terms of her performance, one of the bits that I think really stands out is when there's the bit when she's actually about to. I think it is at the end of the horrendous slaughter scene, and then there's a guy that she hasn't noticed who's coming after her with a knife, and Big Daddy shoots him from a distance, and there's that little moment of panic from her that I think is really well played, because pretty much everything else she does in the film is covered by this ridiculous bravado, but that's when she sort of gets the, you know, the child underneath it kind of thing.
And apparently she learned a lot of that, like the stuff with the butterfly knife, she learned to do all of that herself. And I think quite a lot of the action she is actually on set and present for. Between her and Mark Strong, they do a fantastic job of selling that final fight. You're right, again, not completely sold on the morals of the movie in that final sequence, but the counterbalance between Kick-Ass and Red Mist fighting, having this just absurd fight in one room, and then this kind of like martial arts master of a crime boss that Mark Strong convinces us that he is, showing the skills that he showed off earlier on when he roundhouse kicked the Kick-Ass impersonator in the face. And these two have this absurd fight, and they're both just really, really good at selling it, both like physically and just nailing the absurdity of the scene, that this big 6 foot tall bruising man is fighting this 10-year-old girl, and it's more of a fair fight than the two male teenagers fighting in the other room.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so much you can praise about the entire performance. Like, it comes across as incredibly natural, and I think that's what makes it work. What I think is good about Chloe Moretz is that she inhabits the character so well that, like, you kind of, by the end of it, even though she's a psychopathic killer, you're sort of on her side as a sort of wronged party.
Kind of definitely more so than you are with Big Daddy.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously, the writers clearly felt that way, and director, because she comes back for the sequel as essentially co-lead, if not lead.
I think it would be very easy to hate the characters of Hit Girl and Big Daddy. They could essentially be the villains of this film if Mark Strong wasn't so good at being that villain, and you didn't have Chloe Moretz and Nick Cage playing those two characters.
I think whatever you think about this film, it has contributed Hit Girl to pop culture. Like, I think that's the thing that people are going to remember sort of 20 years down the line.
Yeah. And any other standout performances or characters?
I just did want to mention that I've realised that we have what might be our first back-to-back actor in episodes of Cinematic Universe, which is Corey Johnson, who was your favourite in Hellboy and is also one of the goons in this.
Oh, wow! Amazing. I was, for a second, I was really reaching there to try and figure out what that might have been. I was like, because I never realised that's Elizabeth McGovern as Dave's mum dying at the table in the start. I just never even recognised that was her, and I was like, was Elizabeth McGovern in Hellboy? Or, I mean, Claudia Schiffer's on that billboard. Did Matthew Vaughn let her out of his basement to go and do a scene in Hellboy? But Corey Johnson, fantastic. He is very, very good. Okay, well, on that note, I think we should probably bring our Kick-Ass discussion to a close. But we'll move on now to our recommendation section. Now, given that I've already read Kick-Ass, it's not going to be one of the recommendations. But if you are interested, I'd say there's a lot to enjoy about Kick-Ass on the page, even if it for me isn't quite as good as a film. But if you are interested, listeners, you know, give that a read as well. But Seven James, what are you going to recommend me to read based on Kick-Ass?
I have a favourite Grant Morrison comic that I'm going to recommend you on quite tenuous grounds, but, you know, there's no other way I'm going to get anyone else to read it on this podcast. So my recommendation is a Vertigo comic called Kill Your Boyfriend by Grant Morrison and Philip Bond.
Okay.
And I'm recommending it on the basis that it's got a similar mix of comedy, violence, and sort of suburban life as Kick-Ass. It's not about, it's not about people trying to be superheroes in any way, but I think those elements make it similar enough to justify recommending it.
And is it going to be as confusing or mind-blowing as most of the Grant Morrison stuff that I've encountered so far?
It is a very poppy Grant Morrison comic. It's so accessible, and it's even set in suburban Britain. Yeah. So you should have no trouble with this.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to that one. Seb, what have you got for me?
I'm actually doing a similar thing to James in that I'm recommending you something because this might be the best tenuous excuse I get to recommend it. But actually, I think it's actually not what I was originally going to recommend, and then James guessed that it was going to be my recommendation. I thought, oh yeah, that's a much better suggestion. And it's actually, I think it's got quite a decent link. So on the theme of comics about the idea of superheroes in the real world, I'm going to recommend you a Superman comic.
Ooh.
I can't remember if I've talked about this on the podcast or to you at all before, so I'm curious as to if the name means anything to you, but it's Superman Secret Identity by Kurt Busiek and Stuart Immonen. Have I talked about this before?
I don't know. The name rings a bell, so it's possible, but...
Because if I haven't, I kind of now don't really want to say anything about
okay.
it. I don't even really want to say why I'm recommending it. I think I'd just like to leave you to it,
I
think you'll be able to talk on the minisode about, you'll be able to see why I've recommended it and why it's so distinctive and why it's not a usual Superman story. All I will say is that it's in my top few, not just Superman comics ever, but comics ever. I find it hard to find the words to express just how much I love this comic. And I think it's quite an apt thing to follow Kick-Ass with. So it's a 4-issue miniseries from 2004, written by Kurt Busiek, drawn by Stuart Immonen. It's in print and it's on Comixology, so it should be quite easy to get hold of. And I would usually we're recommending stuff that we like anyway, but anyone listening to this, if you haven't read this comic, please also go and read it, because... Yeah.
Excellent. Well, that sounds very intriguing. I'm going to be looking forward to that one. But we move on now to our final section, which is the pitch. And this week, guys, I'm fairly confident that the two pitches you give to me are not ones that actual real Hollywood would ever want to move ahead with. Because this week, I would like you to pitch me the movie where, just like Kick-Ass Dave Lazowski, you become a DIY superhero. Pitch me the movie where Seb Patrick becomes a superhero and where James Hunt becomes one. Seb, I'll come to you first.
It's only just occurred to me when you said that you should have had us each pitch a movie starring the other one.
Superhero. Right, we'll save that for a future podcast.
Kick-Ass 2.
Thanks for the idea, Seb. Yeah, when Kick-Ass 2 comes around, that is the pitch. That is a long lead tease for the listeners right there.
I think I would have to be Spoiler Man. And my superheroic ability would be to go around trying not to give away the plot details of things and then inadvertently doing so and having everyone getting annoyed at me.
Oh, spoil something now, you've got to. How does it end?
It ends with me getting beaten up by Al Kennedy and Jamie McKelvey.
Oh, fantastic. That's actually a very high mark to live up to, James. What is your DIY superhero going to be?
Mine was going to be Kidney Stabber.
Okay.
I just think, like, there are loads of people who just irritate me on a daily basis. And I was thinking, if I was, like, slightly less hinged, I'd just sort of wait until people got into lifts and just sort of shiv them in the kidneys and then run off.
So I was thinking maybe you've very much taken the Big Daddy approach there and not the Kick-Ass approach.
Yeah, I mean, technically, if you want to get technical about it, it's probably not very heroic to do that.
No, but I think you are a super
really
villain.
It would be
I'm fairly certain you are a super villain. And worryingly, I don't think I could say I could send Spoiler Man to stop you.
As long as he doesn't spoil anything I'm watching.
No, that's the thing, because
what if Spoiler Man shivs, what if Kidney Stabber shivs Spoiler Man in the kidneys?
Yeah.
Oh God.
But then that would make Kidney Stabber a hero. So that's how Kidney Stabber becomes a superhero, by ridding the world of Spoiler Man. There's your crossover. Spoiler Man versus Kidney Stabber, Dawn of Justice.
Oh God. I mean, I can't condone kidney stabbing on the podcast. Maybe if you got Nicolas Cage to play you, I'd be interested. So I think I'm going to have to go for Spoiler Man and Seb to be the victor in this week's pitch.
I'm sorry not to have won that one. What if it was Chris Hemsworth? Because, you know, he's got form.
Chris Hemsworth has kidney stabbing form.
No, he played James Hunt already.
He has form for playing James Hunt.
Oh, playing James Hunt. Oh, wow.
I sense that didn't help my chances any.
That was the second time that something has gone completely over my head on this podcast. It is probably time to bring things to an end. Okay, well, that is it for this week's show. If you're enjoying the show, then please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice. And if you've already subscribed, then please leave us a rating or a review. Just like someone actually has on iTunes in the last couple of weeks, this is Grizzly Worm, who would like to hear us reviewing some old comic book movies too, like the Hoff's Nick Fury or the old Captain America's. They're on our list. We have an extensive Excel spreadsheet with literally hundreds of things that we could potentially discuss on the podcast.
Our list goes back to 1941.
Yes.
Also, we have already done a film older than any of those mentioned.
We have, but well, maybe not older than the Captain America serials.
Oh no, but I thought he meant the 90s one, like the Matt Salinger and stuff.
Anyway, Grizzly Worm left us 5 stars.
Anyway, I'm not having a go at him, because thanks for the 5 stars.
We are very, very grateful for that 5-star review. And if any more come in, we'll definitely read them out on the show. You can find more episodes of Cinematic Universe on cinematicuniverse.libsyn.com, or as a Film Divider podcast at filmdivider.com. You can get in touch via Facebook, on Twitter at CU_podcast. Or send us an email to cinematicuniversepod@gmail.com. See you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Saying I'm responsible for this country's longest run of uninterrupted peace in 35 years. I'm not saying that from the ashes of captivity, never has a phoenix metaphor been more personified. I'm not saying Uncle Sam can kick back on a lawn chair, sipping on an iced tea, because I haven't come across anyone man enough to go toe-to-toe with me on my best day. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with Iron Man 2.